Jeffrey Epstein is a black hole in media coverage, and the implications are extremely unsettling.
The reason I think it's most significant is that it actually could be affecting our foreign policy right now. That's the implication of the allegations about Jeffrey Epstein, which have been made through very credible reporting and non-conspiratorial fringe types.
It's a 180 on the whole transparency mantra. It's the 180 on the whole, we're here, you know, we're the hammer, we're going to drain the swamp. And how they've handled the Epstein case definitely feels a peak swamp to me. So much has happened since we scheduled this thing. I don't even know where to start. So initially, we're going to talk America Party. We're going to talk America Party to start. And then Elon is going to do or not going to do it. Then the whole Epstein thing happened with Trump. And then he's like, there's no file. Here's my thing from the grand jury thing. It's a hoax. Okay, well, we're going to release something. So I don't even know where to start. It's like, how have you taken these last 2 weeks from your perspective, Emily? I've seen you everywhere, too. Like, I've seen you sort of hopping from podcasts. By the way, congratulations on your freaking increased visibility. You fully deserve it. So it's Friday, July 18th. What the hell's going on right now? Can you give us like a just simple lay of the land, you know, in an hour and a half or less?
Well, thanks for the kind words and thanks for having me back. I'd say what's been happening over the last, 10 days since the FBI's Epstein memo dropped. It was a Sunday night news dump. Pam Bondi, the attorney general, and the Department of Justice gave a memo saying they were closing the Epstein case essentially to Axios on a Sunday night, and then talked more about it the next day, of course. And that has dominated everything in the media since it happened. I believe it's been 10 days. But if we rewind the clock to the beginning of this month, it's only July 18th. So actually, we're about halfway through. The Trump administration was able to pass its massive tax package, which was actually really a bundle of all their priorities, through Congress with very narrow margins, get it signed by the president on July 4th for his major ceremonial initiation of the quote unquote one big beautiful bill. Then we started to see, this is all coming off, we should also add, the 12-day war and the bombing of Iran. Then we started to see escalation in Ukraine. And then we've since seen escalation in Gaza. So you have these two hot conflicts escalating in the backdrop of Trump achieving his signature legislative priority. And then a major media scandal unfolding with the Epstein case. So these are news cycles with, I think, a few really clear different layers. And it's just been really difficult. I think it's massively frustrating for the administration. I know it's massively frustrating for the administration that what they feel like was a major win has been completely overtaken by the Epstein story. Now, there's a big question about how much of that is their fault. But it's sort of a segmented news cycle with a really heavy top layer of Epstein. And then all of this other stuff happening in the background. The BBB, they're working right now on what's called a rescissions package. It looks like they've secured a victory in Congress where they're going to be cutting NPR funding, PBS funding, and trying to really pare back some spending, $9 billion worth of spending. And they feel really good about that, too. They feel like that was a win. And now nobody's talking about it either because of the Wall Street Journal scoop on Epstein. So I think the best way to just sort of take it all in is just, you have to look at the Epstein layer on its own, scrape it off, and then you can sort of see what's happening beneath the surface. It's not to say that it doesn't affect some of the other news cycles. It definitely does. It's just that's the only way to kind of segment things right now.
So the one, from my perspective, the whole Epstein thing, I'm trying to figure out if this is sort of an echo chamber big deal or if it's like a broader big deal for the Trump administration and the GOP more broadly. So if I give my perspective so I was a Trump voter, and the Epstein thing to me is it 180 on the, this is my perspective, my purely my opinion. It's a 180 on the whole transparency mantra. It's the 180 on the whole, we're here, you know, we're the hammer, we're going to drain the swamp. and how they've handled the Epstein case definitely feels a peak swamp to me. Mm-hmm. And so is that a echo chamber perspective? Is that a minority perspective? Like, how do you view that from the channels that you've analyzed? Is this like, is this shared by the broader American public, or are we just, am I too online?
No, no, I'm really curious, actually, to hear that from you. I think that's really compelling, because there's this, I think, group of voters who aren't typical sort of Republican base voters, and swung to Trump in 2024. Like Andrew Schultz has been grappling with this over the last couple of weeks as just one example. Theo Vaughn, too, swung to Trump in 2024 because in part, not totally, but in part, he's an anti-establishment guy and said he was going to go back and take on the swamp. And he was going to install these people who are absolute warriors for the sake of transparency. And so I think that the reaction among people in that category, I don't know if you would count yourself in that category. It sounds to me sort of like that's a fair assessment. I think that's an important. Yeah, I actually think that's important. On the other hand,
Farzad is the secret sixth member of Flagrant.
You already got a brown guy there. I'm good.
Yeah. They don't need you. I think two things can be true at once. The media can be using the story as a anti-Trump feeding frenzy, and it can also be important to voters. So what we've seen so far from polling, for example, Quinnipiac had a poll that 65% of people disagreed or disapproved of the Trump administration's handling of this. But CNN and Quinnipiac have also found that support for Trump among Republican voters, and the margin of error here is a little tricky, so take that with a grain of salt, has increased over the last couple of weeks. Well, what explains that? Most people disagree with the Trump administration's handling of the Epstein files. But for most Trump voters, Republicans, and also most Americans in general, they can deeply oppose the way this has been handled and care more about the economy and care more about immigration. And so it's a matter of priorities. Most people, let's say, don't have a really hard position on the Jones Act. They may really disagree with where Donald Trump or Joe Biden comes down on the Jones Act. But they're not voting with it. So you can show a poll number saying 90% of Americans, don't support Trump on the Jones Act. It's not going to make a dent in his approval rating. So I think two things are true at once. People do care about it. They do disagree with Trump on it. It's just not their top issue.
And so do you know why it's not a top issue? Like if I view it from my perspective, again, this is one person and it could be a two online, maybe like just naive sort of take on this, and maybe I just don't understand politics, or maybe I'm blowing this out of proportion. But to me, it feels like this is a really, really, really big deal. That there's essentially a concerted effort to try and, I don't want to use, I mean, cover up or whatever, but there's clearly bad stuff happening, and there is the opposite of transparency. It's forced, like, forget about it, right? Which kind of is like, it's like you're opening a wound and then you're spitting in it. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the analogy I would use, right? And that to me sort of like, I don't know if discredits or just leaves a really bad taste when an administration is so openly doing that. And this is even, and this is me recognizing that Trump's playbook has become quite, I understand his playbook much better since I started following him more closely after the Biden administration. And sort of, I saw that the whole sequence of events with that administration, I'm like, what the hell is going on? And so that side of the political aisle became a little bit more visible to me. I'm like, okay, so he's a shit talker. He's boisterous. He knows how to stay in the media. He's a brilliant marketer. He's a brilliant brand guy. But like, this seems
brilliant
so
troll.
Yeah, it's a brilliant troll. He really is. But he underneath, there's clearly a very intelligent human being that understands how the media works better than probably he's top 0.1% of understanding how media works. And he uses that to drive his platform. Okay. But like, this seems so blatantly opposite. So opposite of what he ran on, what his core group looks for, what human decency looks like. Like, what about, like, you know, we know there are people out there that have suffered from the people involved in the Epstein thing. Like, they physically suffer from this stuff, and we're using that as a political football for this. Yeah. Like, how is this not priority number one? I'm being naive or I'm blowing this out of proportion. I'm fundamentally misunderstanding what is happening here. So help me understand that.
No, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I think it is a hugely significant case. And I think the more people think about it, the more they are in agreement with that position. Now, I just think a lot of people, when they go to the news, aren't sort of looking for that time. I think they like genuinely treat the news as a practical, functional, many people as a functional thing to tell them, you know, what is going on with the markets, what's going on with, you know, conflict and war and all of that. But all of that is to say, the reason I think it's most significant is that it actually could be affecting our foreign policy right now. That's the implication of the allegations about Jeffrey Epstein, which have been made through very credible reporting and non-conspiratorial fringe types. These are allegations that have been printed in Vanity Fair. These are allegations that have been made on the record by people in regards to Epstein's relationship with intelligence.
This is Sagar's interview with Flagrant. He went through it line by line. I listened to that whole thing yesterday. That's what you're referencing, correct?
Yeah. So these are, I mean, he has a documented history going back years and years of close relationships with people in the intelligence world. And it's not speculation, it's serious. And what that could mean is that there are people running our foreign policy right now who are overly responsive to whether it's Israel, some people have said Russia, but to a foreign government. I think Israel's probably the most likely case. And that would just be, by the way, a testament to Mossad. Like, yeah. As dirty as it is, that would be a testament to Mossad. It's not impossible. I mean, one of the things I look at without going too deep into the fever swamp here is that the Epstein memo dropped the day before Netanyahu was visiting the White House. A couple of days after that, an unnamed Israeli official told the New York Times that not all of the enriched uranium had been destroyed in Iran. So that would be information from Mossad. We know our information is coming from Israeli intelligence in large part when it comes to what's happening on the ground in Iran. Again, testament to Mossad. And so what that tells me is, why would you then, purely from a cynical perspective, go blow up the reputation of an allied intelligence organization that is giving you information on a potential hostile nuclear power? So that gives them a lot of leverage. That's why I think the story is particularly important. Obviously, there's a question of justice, substantive justice that has still not been served to many, many victims. And that's by far the most important thing. But in terms of like the news value, that's the most important thing on the moral level. But in terms of like the ongoing value to conversations about our politics at this moment, I think that's why it's really significant. But that's not even what most of the quote unquote mainstream media covers when they talk about Epstein. So I think people don't even necessarily connect the dots because the media hasn't covered it very well.
How much of this is just the like journalists in mainstream media? Like, how much investigative work is required to arrive to that conclusion? Is that work just outside of the scope of today's mainstream media, where they're it's much less investigative and much more like headline run? It's like much closer to me than an actual real journalist, right? Like, what? Like, is that the core issue here? Thank you to the sponsor of this podcast, Rebellion Air. Now, we know a lot of you are Tesla fans, and especially Tesla investors. And if you have more than $1 million of Tesla stock, Rebellion Air could be the perfect fit for you. Rebellion Air is an investment firm that helps Tesla investors reach their financial goals. They do this by helping you plan for your future, and they also institute strategies like trimming and adding, covered calls, etc. So if you're somebody who believes that Tesla has long-term potential, these kinds of strategies could maximize the number of shares you have by the time Tesla reaches those goals. And the guys at Rebellion Air do this by doing so much research on the Tesla story, and they do a lot of novel research as well. Things like doing cross-country full self-driving trips to really gauge and truly understand the capability of that specific software. They've done really novel research around the energy side of the business and other parts of the business as well. And so instead of dealing with a typical investment firm that may give you the cold shoulder by viewing your investment as too risky, the guys at Rebellion Air will help you reach your goals while fully understanding the Tesla story. And so if you're a Tesla investor and you have more than $1 million of shares, and you're interested in finding out more about Rebellionaire, I have a link for you in the description in the comment section below. You can go to rebellionaire.com/Farzad, and that's how they'll know that we sent you. And now back to the podcast.
I'll just say that the connections are not that hard to make, and that, you know, anyone whose salary doesn't depend on a mainstream media page, like, that's where you're finding a lot of this information. And then when you do the homework, it's all credible. Like Emily said, it's much more, seems to be a top-down blackout on discussion of the topic than, you know, the facts are difficult to ascertain, or that the story isn't one that is relevant or saleable. Like, you know, what's going to...
It's a calculated omission.
Yeah, like, it's just this huge, you know, when you look out into the stars and you see this big black spot and you can't figure out why is there nothing there? And then you look closer and you look closer and things around it are bending. You're like, oh, there's a black hole right here. Like, Jeffrey Epstein is a black hole in media coverage, and the implications are extremely unsettling, you know, the closer and the closer that you look for it. And what you can't come away from that investigation with is, oh yeah, there's nothing there. And I think that's what makes Trump's, like, statement that there is no there, like, just leave it alone, stop talking about it, is such a slap in the face, is because, like, we obviously understand that whatever is there is extremely sensitive and must be handled with care and has, you know, huge implications in a number of ways. And I think, you know, it would go over a lot better with the public if he would say, yeah, this is a really hard situation with a lot of second and third order consequences that we have to think about very carefully as we try to unravel this story for you. And there's going to be some things that we can't tell you, and you're just going to have to be okay with that. Like, that would be the truthful, honest situation if they wanted to give us any information whatsoever. I think that would be a lot more palatable to most people. But, you know, it may be that the implications of what's going on, to Emily's point, are so profound that they can't even do that. It's just like, why? We don't understand what is going on there, and how close, you know, at the end of the day, we still live in a world with nuclear powers, and
yeah,
it's easy for people to make moral calculus that thousands of children being sexually abused, while awful, is still less important than the risk of total annihilation of the human race. Like, I don't know. I'm not making any statements about what I know or do not know to be going on here. I'm just saying that it is, you know,
that's,
we live in a
lenses,
very, very complicated world. Yeah. And we're not the ones who have all the information, who have to make these decisions. And that could be a framework that people who do have to make those decisions have to think about these problems through.
I think this is probably the single most underappreciated point in all of American politics and in foreign policy, period, which is that we are less than a century into the human experience with nuclear weapons. It is an experiment. It has been the blink of an eye in the scope of human history. A lot of people say nuclear weapons are a great source of peace. But again, that could be proved dramatically wrong in about a second, because we're not even 100 years into this experiment. Again, just the blink of an eye in the scope of human history. And so when we look back on the Cold War structures that set up the system of secrecy with, like, zero accountability until you get, you know, once in a generation, a church committee, and we find out what the FBI and CIA were doing behind our backs, but a lot of the people are dead, there's no prosecution, et cetera. So that was set up after the Cold War because the fear of nuclear annihilation was so urgent that kids were being taught to dive under their desks. It was immediate, urgent, and dramatic. People had seen in their lifetimes, and still in their lifetimes, there are people living who survived nuclear annihilation in Japan. And so it was a terrifying prospect, and it's been the single source of our insane Cuba policy and our Haiti policy and our policy as regards to NATO for a couple generations now. But it's not entirely irrational. We are starting to have the benefit of hindsight. And some people were saying this in real time, people on the right, like myself, disagreed with. I wasn't alive to disagree with Noam Chomsky, but there were people who disagreed with it bitterly for a very long time. But with the benefit of hindsight, it's becoming increasingly clear that the system, though rational, if you have this well-founded fear, urgent fear of total annihilation, is actually counterproductive. And I think that's where you see the Epstein Mossad, potentially CIA connections coming into play. It's that you're going back with Robert Maxwell to Iran-Contra. You're genuinely going back to the Cold War and the way some of these relationships were cultivated that resulted in Epstein apparently being an asset for one country, multiple countries. And the reason is ostensibly supposed to go back to nuclear protection. It likely doesn't go back to nuclear protection. It likely goes to these different intelligence organizations playing a grand game of chess, as they see it, with one another. And he became one of the big pawns in that grand game of chess. But this is where, we heard all week from MAGA, Joe Biden had information on Donald Trump. Implicating Donald Trump in the Epstein scandal, wouldn't it have come out over the last few years? Well, we just saw the Wall Street Journal publish what appears to be a wild letter from Donald Trump to Jeffrey Epstein on the occasion of Epstein's 50th birthday, where he sketched a naked woman and wrote a weird little thingy. And if the Biden administration had that, the Journal reports it was in the Justice Department's files. My personal theory is that Maureen Comey left the Justice Department, was fired by the Justice Department on Tuesday, and she was a top prosecutor of Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. She may have tipped someone off on all of these documents shortly before she left, or right after she left, based on the timeline. And that's also when Trump started to pin the blame on James Comey for cooking up the hoax. But why would the Biden administration not release that? Because the Biden administration doesn't particularly want to upset Israeli intelligence either, or the CIA, whether it's Israel, CIA, Russia. These are really fragile relationships. And rocking the boat, if you're doing the cost-benefit analysis and you're somebody who believes in those relationships, which I personally wouldn't put myself in that category, but if you're Joe Biden or Donald Trump and you're in that position, that's what convinces you to stay secret. Maybe they have stuff on you too. Maybe someone has stuff on you. I mean, all of these things are not conspiratorial and wild. They're very real possibilities. They just sound insane because we've only learned sort of more about our history in the last couple of decades.
Yeah, and I think that's such an excellent breakdown. And these types of conversations and this type of expose, it would have felt impossible without the rise of sort of independent media, podcasts, long form, et cetera, right? So it's almost like, and because I agree with you, because as we're walking through this and listening to this, like 5 years ago me, or even 6 years ago me, would be like, oh, this is insane conspiracy theory. This is crazy. I'm just gonna go play video games. I'm gonna go outside and touch grass because that sounds crazy. Look at America; it's fantastic, it's beautiful. You know, I'm getting paid, I have a job, et cetera, et cetera. And then the more time we all collectively spend trying to understand actually what is going on since the wake of COVID, I feel like you threw out the number of like 20 years. I want to say like the mass population that, let's say, it's not super engaged in politics or super engaged in history or engaged in understanding like what is happening in the United States of America. I want to understand what is our country's doing. I feel like that cohort has just become engaged in the last 4 years. Like a significant percentage of those people. And to me, it's almost like, and I'm kind of seeing this too in independent media, the types of conversation, and again, this could be my algorithm, but I think that I sense there's something else bigger going on. We loosely talked about this too, but I think last time you came on, where you sort of highlighted the fact that independent media and all these singular voices that are out there, this is just the beginning. We're gonna go more and more towards that. it really feels like we are at the very beginning of a collective sort of contract between a bigger percentage of the population that says, okay, let's try to fucking figure out what the hell's going on. Mm. Let's set aside everything and just, what is going on? What is happening? Why is our government behaving this way? Why is it that Trump is the best option, yet this kind of rhetoric is coming out? And on the flip side, you have a party that is a complete embarrassment to the country, right? And then you end up with this situation where we have this continued cycle of just garbage, just constant garbage in and out. And there's no, it doesn't feel like there's actual, true, honest representation of the moderates and the middle of the country that just wants somebody to tell them what is happening. Mm-hmm. And be honest about the things you can't say. Why is that such a hard thing to achieve? You know?
I think that's right. I mean, I think our political system has become so untethered from the will of the public. And Joe Biden is such a good example of that. Most people said, even most Democrats said, the man was too old to run for re-election in 2024. And it wasn't until he bungled, first 10 minutes of the debate that it was after a couple of weeks even. I mean, it wasn't even just that. It took a couple of weeks of public pressure. Biden to then, again, circumvent any type of mini primary or primary process. And basically Kamala Harris steps in and is coordinated. So that is, I think, such a good example of why the will of the public is not really what Washington is responsive to anymore. And you look at Congress, the omnibus legislation is another great example of that. Why can't they do these things piecemeal? That's the question like every normie has. Like, why do we have to stuff this all into one package? And it's because they have punted so much of their own authority to the executive agencies that they have atrophied. Their powers have atrophied. They're not used to doing legislation. They're not used to building consensus. And so they don't even do it anymore. They're not set up to do it. It's the same system, right? In theory, it's the same system. But in effect, they have all of these, like the way that they do the budgets now has become a pattern where the incentive is to just cram it all in. And they don't have the muscle memory to do anything differently. It's completely insane.
Can I just highlight what you just said? Because I don't think this is common. I mean, this makes sense to me now, the way you've said it. Our legislative branch doesn't actually do legislation. They've offsourced the legislation to third parties to craft it for them. And then they put it together and then they try to pass it through. Is that a fair representation of what you just said?
And specifically to add to that, the reason that they can't do it is because they don't have good enough relationships with one another to agree on things to do.
It's a little bit of both. Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. So on the one hand, because of the polarization of the electorate, Congress is responsive to that in the House of Representatives, at least. Although if you look at like some of the red states, they have some of the most moderate senators because these 6-year cycles allow them to sit on big war chests and defeat any type of primary opponent. So that's a little bit different. But at least in the House of Representatives, yeah, there's such polarization that they've had really slim majorities in either direction for a long time. So when Donald Trump won on repeal and replace, which was the Republican, that for more than half a decade, that was the signature Republican promise. Why could they not do it? Well, some of it was they're not used to doing any of this stuff anymore. And building consensus was hard. They didn't have, that's a whole podcast in and of itself. But anyway, all that is to say, if there was one thing Republicans should have been able to do after Donald Trump won the presidency, they had the House and the Senate, it would have been repeal Obamacare. They couldn't even repeal it, let alone replace it. So part of it is that. The other part of it is they don't. So the executive agencies have usurped, or Congress has delegated to the executive agencies so much power over things like healthcare. That's actually a good example. Like Bobby Kennedy is now in a position where he can do a lot of things without legislation because Congress has empowered HHS to do so much. Congress has empowered the EPA to make so many decisions that probably should be in the hands of people who are elected to make those decisions rather than delegated to career bureaucrats who are not at all responsive to politics. And that's one of the things the Trump administration has very controversially been trying to do with restoring power in the executive branch that the media has, I think, not covered well. The reason there's an ideological argument that has longstanding in the conservative movement about some of these executive agencies just being unconstitutional based on the authorities that Congress has delegated to them. And some of the executive power grabbing that's happening is just genuine ideological conservative belief in the balance of powers. Some of it is probably cynical too, but actually we would have a more well-functioning system. I say this as a conservative, I believe we'd have a much more well-functioning system if, for example, the people at the EPA knew they were going to get their asses fired if they started making decisions that a Republican president in Congress or a Democratic president in Congress would get pissed off about. So that's a really long answer, but the executive agencies, like nuclear warfare, are in many cases less than 100 years old. Some of them are just around that mark. And this all happened with technology making us closer, putting us closer together. It's in some cases like telecom, the FCC, something you kind of need to have in order to govern some of these big bodies. And when you have air travel, you end up having an EPA that does need to cross state lines for some really legitimate reasons. Like these things, some of it is understandable. Some of it, though, is just because of those understandable reasons being used as pretenses for federal power grabs. And that's a really long-winded way of answering the question. But basically, we've just gotten ourselves into a complete mess where the government needs to have its wheels greased.
Yeah, it feels unsustainable. I guess you would agree with me, but I think I'm trying to figure out, is this how this whole system is supposed to feel? Is it supposed to feel like it's unsustainable, and that's the beauty of democracy, that no one gets their way at all, and then we just have this jumbled mess, and we just push the jumbled mess forward? Or is there is this actually the broken? Do we have a broken system that is not working as intended because we don't have, like, I might view Congress as completely unresponsive to the will of the people, but in reality, it's just not working the way I would want it to work, and so that's just how democracy works, right? So like if you were to gauge based on your experience, like which one is a truer statement? Is this a broken system that is actually like fundamentally flawed in some way? Not democracy, but like the way Congress is set up right now and sort of its inability to be responsive to the people and everything that's happening with the Trump administration, the Biden administration. Like, is there something corrupt or something broken fundamentally in there that's not allowing the Constitution and our separation of powers to actually work properly? Or is this democracy? Like, how would you gauge that?
The founders definitely envisioned a very slow system that was not like California, for example. I mean, California is not a federal government, but on the state level, you have governance by referendum, for example. The founders really did not want that for the federal system because they, you know, wanted, what are they, the Senate is the saucer, the cooling saucer, right? They envisioned the separation of powers as such that there would be, institutions, bodies that cool the passions of the people. And that sounds anti-democratic, and it is in a sense. I mean, we are not a strict democracy. We are a constitutional republic. And the reason for that's why we didn't have direct election of senators, for example, for a really long time, is it sounds sort of elitist. But the idea wasn't so much to just empower elites. It was to say we are empowering ourselves to empower other people to cool all of our passions. And so I don't particularly think the Constitution needs any sort of update. I mean, I'm all in for, you know, term limit amendment and that type of thing. And we do have a process in place. On the other hand, to accomplish amendments and all of that stuff, it hasn't been used in a very long time, interestingly enough. On the other hand, the way that I look at it is our class of elites is less capable of governance in a way that is less reflective of the political system and more reflective of cultural rot. I think there just used to be a sense of shame that doesn't exist anymore. Of course, there have always been shameless politicians, but the cultural stigma around corruption is very different. The cultural stigma around the way you conduct yourself as a lawmaker is very different. I think that's the significant change. And I think a lot of that is some people would say that's in and of itself downstream of politics. I don't buy that. They, of course, interact with each other. I think a lot of it is downstream of technological shifts that have, of course, been influenced by politics. But I don't think any of this is going to be significantly altered by a different political system. I think as a people, as a culture, we have devolved in some ways that are making, you know, as John Adams said, our system is only one for a moral people. I think he said a moral and religious people. And his definition of moral and the founder's definition of moral, that's the software that the political hardware had to run on. And, you know, that's how they saw the software. And I think there's a pretty good argument when you look at the last 100 years that the software has changed.
That's actually a very eye-opening, interesting way of looking at it. Go ahead, Hans.
Well, maybe this is a good point to ask the question. What I guess the first question is, what do you think is likely if Elon, I mean, he says he's going to do something. The question is what do you think Elon is going to do? And if you, what would be the best bang for his buck if he was going to do something?
I think he will probably do what is the best bang for his buck, which is to start putting money behind people in primaries and maybe even generals who we actually saw this years ago. A guy named Grover Norquist, if you've heard of him, started having Republicans and I think probably some Democrats in the early days sign a pledge that said they would not increase taxes, basically, period. You just wouldn't increase taxes. I could see Elon Musk starting to put money behind people who just come to him and say, I'm going to be a candidate that promises never, ever to vote for a penny going to increase the debt or the deficit. And if he did that, basically you could create a version of the House Freedom Caucus or the Squad even that is, you know, after a midterm cycle, you could maybe see it being five members deep. And if you have any like voting bloc like that, that is hard and fast against debt and deficit, in a really divided Congress, which is likely going to be the case again when we look at the map, that five-member block becomes very powerful, and you have to negotiate with them. So I could see him doing something like that. And it's sort of, to answer the question, it's two birds with one stone. It's both, I think, the most plausible path forward for him. It's sort of low-key. It's not super high-profile political activism. It's something that you can cultivate with some smart consultants in the background. And, you know, he could end up a year from now fielding three to five candidates who are in really good shape to vote as a block. And so, you know, he already has Thomas Massie, basically. You know, not that Thomas Massie would sign anyone's pledge, and God bless him for it, but you know, you could see something like that. It would be, I think, an efficient way to spend money, and it would accomplish his goal of being a little bit lower profile and not so involved in the daily mix.
Would these five seats be strictly in the Senate, or would it be wherever he can get them? Like, how do you think about the math?
I would think of it in the House.
In the House, okay.
Yeah, because the Senate is smaller, and they're only up for election every 6 years, so
tougher
it just
to flip.
It's really hard to flip, and the Senate also tends to be career politicians. It costs more money, but if you can do it in the House, then everything that goes to, I mean, anything that would end up on the president's desk is going to be influenced by the House. So if you have a key voting bloc in a narrowly divided House of Representatives, then you control the Senate too, basically. So yeah. It's that would definitely be an efficient use of his money.
Got it. Talking about this third party, so even if it's Elon or not Elon, that same Quinnipiac,
right? Yeah.
That same study had a, if correct me if I'm wrong, there was something about an independent party,
yeah,
right?
It said, and most people would be willing to support a third party, just not one from Elon.
Just not by, well, not with Elon, exactly, right? Which was, I think it was 17% would support, 70 some odd percent wouldn't approve. And the ones that, the biggest block of people that would approve, I think, were conservatives, and Democrats was like 2% or something that they would support or whatever. I forget what the actual number was, but there is it seems like there is a thirst for an actual third party of some sorts.
17% is not bad, by the way. Like
for Elon,
I don't think it's bad for any third party. I mean, but specifically for Elon,
a heck of a lot more support than libertarians have, or the Green Party, or any of the other options.
Yeah. It's a low bar.
So do you think 17 is an act? Is that enough to actually make some noise in 26? You think, or you think that number needs to be bigger?
In like a midterm cycle, I think. Yeah. Well, it depends on if he goes full third party. And like, if I were his consultant, God forbid, I would say don't go full through third party. Like, this is how Donald Trump was successful, is he didn't run as a third party candidate. He basically completed a hostile takeover of the Republican Party by working from within. And so there's already a group of people who identify more as Republicans who are just as furious about the debt and deficit and the way Republicans add to the debt and deficit as Elon Musk and as people who would be interested in a third party. So you're starting from a pretty good base on the right already. So I would say if you just start fielding some Republican candidates who run as Republicans rather than independents, and you don't identify yourself as the Elon party or whatever, that's probably going to be more powerful than if he starts an anti-debt party. You can do that with AfD in Germany because they have they don't have the two-party system that we have. But here, the right are, I mean, most Republican voters, it's sort of what we were talking about with Epstein, like, they are disgusted by the national debt. It's just not their number one voting issue. But there are some people for whom it is. And if you can get candidates for whom that is the number one issue and they will vote everything based on Congress, everything in Congress based on that ideology, but they're also able to capture appeal in a small district, red district or something like that, man, you could do so much. And the Freedom Caucus is a really great example of how, like, they changed politics. They changed the Republican Party. They in some ways made room for Donald Trump and the Republican Party by voting as a bloc.
Yeah, it's my opinion is the fact that the national debt is not the number one issue really highlights how broken everything else is. Mm-hmm. Right? When 20% of your outflows, 18 to 20% of your outflows, like the money you take in, 20% of it will be attributed to the interest on the debt. And that is not the biggest issue. That's fucking crazy to me. But mm-hmm. I'll set that aside for now. I want to pull this up real quick. So this was the study from the Quinnipiac thing. So there was, would you consider joining a third party as an alternative to the Republican Democrat parties? 49% yes would consider, 45% would not consider. And then the ones that would mostly consider would be independents at 75%. 49% of men versus 45% no, and then 49-45% for women. Republicans was 28% considered, 39% of Democrats. And then the follow-up was, would you consider joining a third party if it was Elon Musk? 17% yes, 77% no. Republicans at 18%, Democrats at 6%, independents at 22%, men at 20%, women at 14%. So I just wanted to show that to the audience. Go ahead, Hans.
So I have an inside baseball question for Emily that you may or may not know the answer to. Like, how does the Republican Party get Ron Johnson to vote for the one big beautiful bill?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's after his, what was it, like a 2-hour deep to Carlson.
And sorry, can we give some background on who Ron Johnson is? Because I have no idea.
He's a senator, yeah. And he's comes from the Freedom Caucus, correct?
So Freedom Caucus is on the House side, but he's definitely sort of aligned with the Tea Party movement. He came out of the Tea Party movement. Ron Johnson comes out of the Tea Party movement. I went back, I actually interviewed him in June as the bill was being mulled on Capitol Hill, and I went back and watched a lot of his old ads. And a lot of his old ads were definitely about fiscal sanity, that sort of thing. He was first elected in 2010, so that is the Tea Party wave. And Tea Party sort of spawns the Freedom Caucus on the House side. So people who are affiliated with the Tea Party, I think it's fair to say, are in a similar vein of the Freedom Caucus type people. And the way Johnson ultimately got to a yes on the bill, they sweetened the pot with all kinds of immigration enforcement. So that's huge. And secondly, he got more cuts by being so opposed to the original versions of the bill that were going to add, by Congressional Budget Office projections, even more to the debt deficit. And so the way I also interviewed Rand Paul in June, and the way he explained this is he said, if I wasn't posturing as a staunch no to this bill, and he ultimately voted against that, if they had needed his vote, I don't know how he would have voted. So a lot of times they make room for Rand to kind of make a protest vote, or Susan Collins to make a protest vote. If they had needed his vote to pass the bill, that would have been a different question, whether or not he would have voted for it. But he said, and this is, I guarantee you how Ron Johnson was looking at it, if I had not postured as a staunch no, then the bill would have been even worse. So the way Ron Johnson gets to a yes, ultimately, is they give him a little bit more. They make the bill a little bit worse from his perspective. And then at the end of the day, doing nothing is kind of the more of the two evils. Like, that's the maximal of the two evils. The less of the two evils is doing something that helps immigration, doing something that makes a dent, even if it's a tiny, tiny, tiny one, in Medicaid, and doing something that makes a dent in federal spending. That's worse than doing nothing. Plus, the tax cuts were going to expire, and so taxes would have gone up. And that's something that a kind of Tea Party type would never want anyway. So you're either doing something or you're doing nothing. And you have to make the something just a little bit better. I think that's ultimately, they gave him some cuts. They gave him like more Medicaid cuts and got him around on that. So it's a fucked up process. Like, it's an incredibly fucked up process.
Well, I mean, I think it just goes to show how the deficit continues to, you know, be very large, and how the debt always grows, is that the people who care about the issue, the swamp knows how to maneuver, you know, outmaneuver them and put them in a position where it's like, it can either be like really, 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 really bad, or just like really bad. And so, you know,
that's,
we're
going to
vote for really bad.
And that's the problem of governing by omnibus, is that everything gets jammed into one bill. So you are always being asked to vote for the lesser of two evils. And that's a horrible way to manage a federal budget, because everything increases. Everything is ultimately more spending. Like, the amount of border spending, which I would argue is close to necessary, if not totally necessary, in that bill, I mean, it like dwarfs some of the biggest cuts that were made. So it's a mess when you govern by omnibus.
One of the shows that I like to follow with, and I believe you were on Mark's show recently, or he mentioned you were going to be two-way.
Oh, Halpern,
guys.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Awesome show, by the way. Everybody should check it out, as well as Emily's show on Undercurrents and with Megyn Kelly and all that good stuff. We'll make sure we have a link for all that stuff. So one of the things that they've mentioned on that show is that it does seem like this big beautiful bill is unpopular. So how unpopular, and is it going to have a impact in the midterms next year? How are you reading that situation?
Yeah, I was interviewing Republican congressman this week on Capitol Hill, actually, about that, because Trump right now is underwater on immigration. This was from the Quinnipiac poll. He's underwater on immigration. He's underwater on the economy, and he's underwater on foreign policy. So that's a bad sign. And in the generic congressional ballot, which is where people are asked whether they would support a Republican or Democrat in the midterm elections, among the most animated voters, Republicans are down 7 points right now. And among all voters, they're down 3 points right now. So I was asking congressmen about that, and they are basically betting on the one big beautiful bill getting kicking in to the economy soon. In fact, they said that's why they passed it when they did. That's why they set their sort of July 4th deadline. It's one of the reasons they did that. So they believe genuinely that the big beautiful bill will get more popular as the results trickle into the economy and into people's pocketbooks, basically, with all of the industrial policy, even though they didn't want to call it that, for reinvesting and reshoring in America. They had all kinds of tax write-offs on manufacturing, building, and those sorts of things. They believe that's going to spur a lot of job creation, revitalize certain local economies. They believe the taxes, no tax on tips and no tax on overtime, are going to be really popular. And then when people start seeing their tax returns a year from now, that's also going to be really popular. So they're pretty convinced that even if it's not popular now, it ultimately will be, and that, you know, the tariffs are going to work a lot better now that there's this reshoring industrial policy basically passed into law with the bill. That's their position on this. It may or may not be true. So some of that depends on how Trump himself handles the tariffs going forward. If some of these deals start coming through, I don't know, but that's what they think.
Yeah. Do you think the Democrats are well equipped to take advantage of these low approval numbers? So, I mean, you have the Epstein thing going on that we talked about. You have disapproval, a majority disapproval, and some of the most biggest core issues of the party. The Republicans love it, but everyone else is kind of like, a huge majority is like, no, we don't like it. Do you? And I saw you dropped the video this morning. I haven't had a chance to watch it yet, but it was about Mamdani. It seems like there's some sort of fracturing in the Democrat Party that might cause some issues, but I don't know if that's going to extend into the midterms next year. Do you think they're well equipped, or do you think they have a narrow enough advantage that they're going to stumble in the midterms, retain their power, or are we too far away to call it per se?
No, I think they're in a really bad position right now. And Mamdani is a very good example. The Democratic Party consolidated behind Andrew Cuomo for one of the largest cities in the world, probably the most important and powerful city in the entire world. The Democratic Party consolidated behind arguably the worst candidate that you could possibly nominate to take that seat. Even though he has very high name recognition, his name recognition is completely tainted with corruption at this point, and the mismanagement of COVID and the sexual scandals. So the idea that they consolidated behind them, just behind him, out of pure muscle memory and pure reflex of loyalty and deference to those party soldiers, that's why they're in the position that they're in right now. That's how you end up with Joe Biden. That's how you end up with Kamala Harris. And nothing is really changing, to be honest. You see some trickles of recognition that they lost Joe Rogan. They should get Joe Rogan back. And they lost the TikTok universe, and they lost the culture and some of these bro institutions, as they would see it, tilted away.
Tech bros.
The tech bros. Yeah, they lost Silicon Valley and all of that. But what have they done that takes a step in the direction that would culminate in recapturing that support? Like, absolutely nothing. And so their best bet in the midterms is that Trump is really unpopular, and that MAGA Republicans in swing districts are really unpopular, so that even bad Dem candidates prevail. And that's, by the way, like how Donald Trump won the primary in 2016, is that all the other Republican candidates got absolutely steamrolled by him because they saw him. Republican, some 30% of primary voters, maybe more, saw him as less bad than Jeb Bush, less bad than Ted Cruz, whatever it was. So that can still work for Democrats. It worked in 2020. Maybe it'll help. But for the long term, the party has absolutely no direction of what's appealing, they're struggling in the microculture environment. They don't have a leader. They don't have direction. They've got nothing right now. And I don't think that's good for anybody. I don't think that's good for the American public.
I agree. I mean, it seems like this is one of the weaknesses of our current two-party system, is that we keep lowering the bar for what's acceptable. And now at the point, you know that whole like South Park sketch with the turd sandwich and the douchebag? You ever see that thing? It's like a representation of like, okay, our politics. It's like a turd sandwich versus a douchebag. Who's the winner? Blah, blah, blah. It just feels like that's where we are. It's just, we just keep lowering the bar, keep lowering the bar, keep lowering the bar. And then eventually we're going to have, I don't know what we're going to have. You know, it's like, anyway, Solange, go ahead. That's just that visual of the South Park thing came to mind.
Yeah, it is just incredibly salient political commentary, always was and always will be. But the question that I wanted to ask Emily is, how much of the Democratic Party's struggles come down to a hangover from COVID specifically? Telling the entire world this did not come from a lab. We're telling you it didn't come from a lab. You're not even allowed to insinuate that it came from a lab. If you do, we're going to nuke you off of the face of the internet forever.
We're going to kill your livelihood.
I mean, I think this is one of the things why
fucking crazy.
Why Trump's
oh my god.
don't talk about the Epstein thing is so triggering is because we all,
that's a good point.
We all were gaslit in this, like it triggers that instinct. Like, no, y'all friggin' science, you know, go back to John Stewart. Science is trying to solve the problem that science created, and you won't let the rest of the world even talk about the fact that this is what just happened. And so, like, how much of the Democratic Party struggles are an attachment to that traumatic event for so many people that they're just like, and this is one of the things that just I honestly cannot even begin to comprehend how Andrew Cuomo is their nominee when he's like poster child. You know, him and Gavin Newsom are almost like the face of Democratic fumbling with COVID.
No, I think there are two really specific issues that keep dragging Democrats down in ways that both voters and politicians are unaware. I think we all underestimate the like psychic baggage that we carry with us into the voting booth from COVID. And I think also from the Biden cover-up, I think some voters are totally conscious of the way that affects their perceptions of establishment Democrat politicians. And Andrew Cuomo is basically the mascot of the Democratic establishment. And that is going to translate. I mean, that's sort of the warning, right? Like he happened to face a particularly formidable Democratic socialist opponent, and they just weren't expecting that. Same thing with AOC and, you know, what happened with Joe Crowley. But this was on a much bigger scale, I think, particularly because of what Cuomo represents with COVID. I just talked to a lot of like students, like part of my job, I go around, talk on college campuses and you know, do different things with students and journalists. As I've been talking to them over the course of the last year, it just struck me, you know, I was in my late 20s when COVID hit. And for them, some of them were early teens, middle school, high school, and the way that it is just absolutely upended, you know, their voting age now, it's upended everything for them and they blame it. And I just think some of it is subconsciously projected onto the Democratic establishment because they were so bad. But also some of it is super conscious, and particularly with younger people who came out in big numbers for Zohra Mamdani to vote against Andrew Cuomo. I really think that Democrats do not understand the lingering effects of it at all. And how, maybe it's because it's too soon. I don't know. It's 2025, and in some blue states, it's like COVID just ended in 2023, and we don't maybe have enough distance from it, but that it reshaped people's lives forever. And, they haven't forgotten it.
So what do you think happens then? So what's the likelihood Mamdani gets elected in New York, you think?
Right now he's leading in the polls in matchups that include Cuomo, Adams, and Sliwa. And, you know, it's really tight. It's like, I think the last I saw was 26 to 23%. I want to say it was a YouGov poll that was released earlier this week. I expect one shoe to drop. Either Cuomo gets out or Adams gets out. That seems unlikely right now, I know. But as powerful factors start, you know, really freaking out about the potentiality of a Mamdani win, I just think something's going to happen in the background to force probably Cuomo to get out. And that might give
Adams...
What
are you talking about, Emily? We've never seen gerrymandering in response to these types of events in the past.
It'd look a lot like what happened in South Carolina in the 2020 election when Bernie Sanders was on the cusp of overtaking Joe Biden and the Democratic establishment managed to get Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg to drop out, endorse Biden, consolidate the vote behind Biden. We may see something similar happening in the background in New York. That would be my guess as of right now. And that's enough to put probably Adams over the edge. That's my guess. But I think Mamdani could win citywide. I also, though, think you're going to start seeing so much more about his sort of cultural baggage, his position on policing, his position on immigration, and that'll ultimately be a boost to whomever is running against him, whether it's two or one establishment candidates.
And lest we, you know, be accused of favoritism, the Republican Party did some pretty shady overnight rule change tricks when Ron Paul.
Oh yeah, they always.
At the cusp of being a legitimate candidate in which election?
Wow,
that's
such a deep 2008? 2012. I want to say that would happen in 2012. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that was the never again Republican Party for me.
Interesting. really interesting.
And I, you know, I think there are a lot of Ron Paul supporters, which, you know, he still has a huge following and huge respect, that it just was a revealing moment. You know, so when I saw what they did to Bernie in the Democratic Party, I was like, oh yeah, like these are the same people. Like, this is how this works.
I think there is a contingency of people that might be growing, or perhaps maybe I shouldn't say that. I think that it's fair for someone to try and judge a politician. Not fair. It should be like almost necessary to be like, hey, are you an honorable, honest person? Are you in the position of power because you deserve it? Like, you're leading.
Are you talking about Epstein again?
But I think that's part of the issue. It's like that sort of framework has broken for a long time. And I think more and more people are connected. More and more people are informed by independent sources and long form conversations. And they're having more and more insights, and they're getting more questions. And yeah, are a lot of those questions like conspiratorial and potentially stupid? Of course. But at least there's questions. At least there's questions, and at least there's information flow and ideas flowing from one place to another. And I view like Mamdani sort of, I think the way you framed it, Emily, is really good. I also think there is a sort of like that, I think that contingency is going to grow. I think for the next 5-10 years, I think Mamdani is just the beginning of something much bigger. And the reason why I say that is I think folks, the AI disruption that's coming in the next 5 to 10 years is only going to fuel that sort of, the system is not working for me. Because now the system's going to come through. AI is going to displace drivers. AI is going to displace white collar work. AI is going to displace blue collar work through robotics. And there's going to be a transitionary period where the economy is going to get flipped 180. And there's going to be more and more people that are going to say, see, the promise of the economy is no longer there for you anymore. We have to change the rules of the game. We have to figure out how we, the people, can actually start winning in this economy. And I think this is just the beginning.
Well, I was going to say that's an optimistic take, because what worries me is that we've already descended into apathy. And one of the reasons, you end up seeing Biden nominated despite, you know, public thinking he's too old back in 2024 is that people already are so deeply frustrated with the system as a whole, they aren't like organizing, mobilizing, and doing everything they can to prevent that from happening. If 65% of Democrats or whatever the number was were like, this dude is too old to be president, please don't force him on us again. And so I worry that with more AI, we end up with more apathy and with more, I mean, I think that's sort of, to me, that's what it looks like the history of the last 10 plus years is people are just getting totally disillusioned and, more siloed and isolated. Loneliness is up. I wonder if that correlates with political apathy in our future. And apathy is obviously seized on by elites who do with it what they will. And then basically the entire country becomes Gotham, where you have a totally hollowed out middle class and a desperate lower class, but a very well-to-do upper class that can, for example, afford their own private security, so they let the police department go to hell. Those types of things. That's the nightmare scenario. And I've honestly,
is that Gotham or San Francisco?
Yeah, exactly. But really, I mean, it's so apt when you look around some of these major cities and you realize like it's. So anyway, that's my pessimistic take.
So what's it like? Okay, so. Or realistic, right? So what's if you were to gauge like the percentage chance of that outcome happening, what percentage chance would you give it? The one you just,
I just don't know. I mean, I just don't know. I think it's, to me right now, it feels very likely to me. On the other hand, there are things that give me a lot of optimism, like the changes in media. I'm shockingly optimistic about. Even if some of the new media stuff is bad, so much of it is good. It's creating competition that's, I think, making, for example, the New York Times better. Not great, but better. And so those are all positive trends. We're becoming better news consumers, and that'll help.
CNN's got Scott Jennings.
That's right. and on the other hand, though, it's just some of these deeper questions. you know, loneliness, for example, or you know, just like misery. Happiness has been declining in the United States for decades, despite material prosperity increasing. You know, we live in bigger homes, and home ownership is a problem in and of itself. But like square footage, Arthur Brooks has numbers on this, and they're fascinating. In the Atlantic, like we have TVs, we have all this stuff, bigger TVs, smartphones, and we're less happy. And that's the trend I just don't think is changing. And I feel like it's really started to bleed into politics.
I think that's a very, I mean, I agree with your take. I think the missing variable there that's tough to like find is a hope for a better future. Mm-hmm. Like, what does a better future look like? Has anyone actually visualized what a better future looks like? You know, like especially from politicians, you know, they
Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson, that's the whole first chapter of Abundance.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I actually bought the book. I haven't had a chance to read the book yet, but I think that is in a lot of ways, like I disagree with Ezra's politics quite a bit, but I think the framing of that concept is 1000% correct. Is what, like, where are we going? What's the future look like? What does a good future look like? What are the policies of today that we have to put in place to ensure 50 years from now we have a good future? You know, landing on the moon or not, depending if you're a conspiracy theorist, but landing on the moon like you know 60, 70 years ago, to me that was a perfect example of the United States saying, look at what we can do, right? These like giant goals that we've put forth for society. I feel like that's the kind of thing we need. It's like inspirational especially for the younger generation.
Optimism hangover really ever since then. Like that was literally the last big, grand, optimistic national that we undertook.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing, I think that's actually really like the issue at the end of the day is that we don't have consensus on where the country should go, what good is. Like we don't have a collective idea of what that is, because for a long time we all sort of agreed on this idea of the American dream. And maybe there's some good to that left, but listen, I'm a conservative and I think the cultural left eroded the consensus around whether the American dream is a good thing or a bad thing. I think one of the reasons you have a lot of loneliness and misery is that you have a lot of young single and aging single unmarried people who have debt and don't have kids, and they were told that these lives would make them fulfilled and happy, and by the time it was too late to change your mind, you look around and you're like, oh, this didn't work. And so that's my position as a conservative Christian, and that's why I'm probably even more pessimist. Is I think some of these I think we had a really historically exceptional period of prosperity in the United States in the post-war time. And I think it was, again, it's an exception. We were very spoiled and we can still be prosperous and in a good position here in the United States of America. And because we have that baseline, you know, people like us who saw our grandparents have it and to some extent our parents have it, we have that baseline. And so it's really disappointing to not see some of that same movement, towards the moon, literally, towards civil rights, towards those achievements. When that slows, Peter Thiel's written about this, it doesn't feel good. It feels extra bad, even if your conditions are still improved from where they were in 1900 or, 1942. So it's, I think some of it is that. And I just worry about some of these, devaluing what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman, what it means to be in a family. Like those things really scare me. And I think they have contributed a lot to the atomization that's now sort of bleeding into our political lives.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of that. I think one of the reasons from my perspective why the sort of this like tech bro movement exists, and if I'm going to say like why does Elon Musk getting 17% is actually a good sign for him potentially, even though it's very low for the rest of the parties, is that, if I'm going to speak on my behalf and maybe for a few other folks out there that is sort of my core audience, we view technology as one of those things that could actually make the future better. Like it's like the future can be better through these incredible technological feats, going to Mars, like actually going to reusable, regenerate, like using the sun to actually power the entire world. that we have an infinite nuclear bomb in the sky that we can harness to power everybody. And that energy will be essentially free, you know, and that's going to allow us to have abundant clean water, abundant clean air. We can do so many great things with technology, right? Self-driving
infinite
cars.
Laundry folding robots.
Yeah, infinite laundry
off
folding
the grid
robots.
Too. Off the grid, too.
Off the grid. Exactly. You know, self-driving cars where the 40,000 people die in the United States every single year from car accidents. Half of them are because of distracted drunk driving. That goes to zero. We get to, you know, so that's that contingency that, that sees a hopeful future. And that's why, like, that's why this channel even exists in the first place, is to kind of talk about those things. Because I feel like there's a lot of hope in using technology to make the future better. There's also the flip side of that is like, okay, now you have social media rotting people's brains.
Right.
Now you have, you know, 45% of teenage girls saying that they're anxious because they're comparing themselves to somebody else on Instagram.
Right.
But that's the flip side of it, right? But at least the hope is obvious and it has materialized. Like, we've actually seen it come to life, right? So it's like, it's like, what is that unifying thing that we can have for everybody to say, okay, that we all agree that's better, right? We all agree that's better. Now let's talk about how we get there. But like, it's not talked about. We're talking about yesterday's problems and not what tomorrow should look like, because we have too many of yesterday's problems. You know, we had the open border. We have a shitty economy that doesn't serve the bottom half. We have, a crazy debt situation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, our healthcare costs are skyrocketing. Obesity is at 40%. Anxiety and depression's going up. Like, okay, at some point, we got to say, okay, just pause the problems. Let's focus on the good stuff. Like, where can we go? You know?
And as you're saying that, I mean, I think really the fault line in this is pro-human versus anti-human. And the goal then is to build consensus on what's pro-human and what's anti-human. And that's one of my favorite. I don't actually follow Brett Weinstein that closely. I like Heather Hying a lot, but I think their book, A Hunter-Gatherer's Guide to the 21st Century, from a couple of years ago, is just essential reading. Like, it's, it goes through some of these, you know, parts of modern life that people don't think twice about, that have just, if you're, you know, under the age of 50, have maybe always existed. And especially if you're under the age of like 20, you like birth control, for example, seems like it's always been a fact of life. But some of these things that are technological achievements have, you know, you just sort of have to rethink the way that you generate new human powers so that they are for the good biologically of a human being, and they're used in a way that's good biologically for a human being. You know, Ozempic, for example, are there good applications of it? Absolutely. Are there bad applications of it that we might have previously just slept, walked into? Yeah. And there's some more awareness about this right now. That's the whole MAHA movement, essentially. So, if there's anything to be hopeful about, I think it is that we're waking up, banning phones from schools, those types of things. But I don't know. I'm so pessimistic.
No, I agree, though. I think that talking like this podcast is an example, right? Sagar going on Flagrant and talking openly, talking about this train of thought around the whole Epstein situation. What is the most likelihood thing that is happening here, and it being distributed to millions of people on Google, right? That's a very good thing. All the different discussions that we've had that are very complex and difficult in long form formats that 3-4 years ago would have been completely and utterly shut down.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of stuff that gets me super optimistic. It's almost like we have to go through the valley to get to the mountaintop. It's just now we're going through the process of going through the valley. We have to go through it, right? That's where whatever optimism I have left comes from.
No, I think that's possible.
You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's possible too. I think it's possible.
Yeah. I mean, to Emily's point, all these things that have the power to make life optimistic, or, you know, create abundance, or, you know, make this hopeful, beautiful future, like the power to make it a beautiful future also, you know, has the flip side capacity to make it a terrible future too. So it's like we have to point a whole lot of human brain power about how, you know, figuring out exactly how to tilt it in the direction of a positive outcome instead of a negative one, which is why, you know, these conversations are so important, and having so many smart people be able to, you know, throw around the ideas and really explore the space of possible outcomes, and then hopefully have, you know, lots of different companies and different institutions try lots of different things too, and, you know, get data on how to actually achieve outcomes. But it is, you know, it is scary because government seems to be so divorced right now from outcomes-based
policy
that, you know, just whatever sounds good is the thing we're going to do. And when we find out that it's accomplishing the exact opposite of what we intended, we're just going to go with it anyways, because, hey, we're doing it, so let's do some more. Mm-hmm. That's the biggest scary thing in all of it to me.
We know this would be working if Congress had a podcast where they were talking about this.
God forbid. Really? Oh my gosh. Yeah,
this is the thing.
The God forbid is the problem. It shouldn't be God. It should be like, yes, our leader should be talking about this shit.
But openly. Our leaders, I feel like one of the saddest things, if you're, it's like the House of Representatives is supposed to be representative of the country. And we have this level of intolerance. It's a mistake that I think I made early in my career when I was like, Marjorie Taylor Greene, what a joke. Or like Ilhan Omar, ugh, get out of here. But like, actually, the House of Representatives is supposed to encompass the rabble. It's supposed to be representative of the people. Now, ideally, the best version of the people. But that means the vast spectrum of American viewpoints. And the sad reality is that most people, even in the House of Representatives and especially in the Senate, are just in the bureaucracy. Vanilla, brain dead, uninteresting, and totally un. What's a good word? They're not dynamic people. They're not sending their best.
They're all Kamalas.
It's a very boring group of people. Not sending their best.
Can we end that on a positive note? What's the best meal you had in the last week?
Oh, I went to a great, they reopened this restaurant by the White House called the Occidental. It was really good. I ate there. Fantastic. They had like a hash brown, like a fancy hash brown. Really good.
Okay. The Occidental?
Yeah, the Occidental.
All right, go check them out. Emily, any parting words before we wrap this sucker up?
No, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Always like trapping it up with you guys.
Yeah, same. Where can people find you?
I'm on social media at Emily Jashinsky, and you can find me on YouTube at Emily Jashinsky too.
Awesome. Go check them out. We'll put the links in the description.